Welcome to World of DAS, a show for data enthusiasts. I'm your host, Warren Hoffman, CEO of Safegraph and GP of Flex Capital. For more conversations, videos, and transcripts, visit safegraph.com/podcasts. Hello, fellow data nerds. My guest today is Meb Faber. Meb is the CEO and Chief Investment Officer of Cambria Funds, which has 14 ETFs and $2 billion in assets. He's also the host of the Meb Faber Show, which covers investing and global financial landscape. Meb, welcome to World of DAS.
Great to be here. Longtime listener, first time participant.
Awesome. I love it. All right. Well, okay, you published this cool list of beliefs that you hold that the vast majority of your peers disagree with. What are some of those beliefs that are like most controversial? Let's just get right into it.
Oh, man. Just cannonballing into the pool, huh?
Exactly.
I kind of live in the macro world, broad investing space. And what you hear most of the time, you turn on TV, Bloomberg, CNBC, whatnot, people love talking macro because macro is interesting. There's always crazy stuff going on in the world somewhere.
What the interest rates are or Middle East problems or those types of things.
Exactly.
Because that's you sound smart when you talk macro.
And it skews a little pessimistic, so that gets that angle. So we started this list, and it's 20 strong, I think, at this point. But the concept was you sit down at one of your famous dinner parties, and you make this statement with a bunch of people in the industry, so professionals, 75% would shake their heads or say, Meb, you're an idiot. Some are very specific. Some are very triggering, but we'll do a couple. I think the one that almost no one agrees with would be, and I don't even have a strong opinion on this, but say something along the lines of the Federal Reserve has done a good job. No matter who you are, you either think one of two things, interest rates are too high or they're too low. The Fed needs to raise, the Fed needs to cut, on and on. Everyone thinks the Fed are just a bunch of idiots. And I have a bit of a conspiracy theorist take, which is, I think the Fed just goes to the meetings, they get a six-pack of beer, maybe some White Claws, perhaps, some white wine. They watch reruns of Seinfeld, and they just peg the Fed funds rate to the two-year bond. And if you pull up a long-term chart of the Fed funds rate versus the two-year, it's like they're twins. Sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's lower. But on average, I think they could just put it on autopilot. So you say that, no one agrees with that one because you end up on either side no matter what. No one ever is okay with the path of interest rates.
But if they could just put on autopilot, what's even the need for them? Couldn't we just automate the Fed or something? Or
I think they should. You know, they get some data nerds like us in there and they probably could. The problem is you get into our world of investing where so much is driven by the animal spirits and you start to get into expectations. And if everyone's targeting this certain number, does that change things?
So there has to be some uncertainty in there.
It makes a fun behavioral question, but it's great to talk about on TV because you can never disprove what someone said. There's no alternate reality in the metaverse where we can look and say, oh, had they not raised interest rates, on and on. But I'm pretty sure that if I was to give most investors a playbook with the path of interest rates, I'm not sure it would help them. I don't know if they would be better off or not.
What do you think are the factors that most people just frequently overlook when it comes to their own investment portfolios?
Factors has a special meaning in my world. So if you say factors, it could mean things like PE ratio or on and on. So you got me on the two other things that trigger people when I get on Twitter would be stock buybacks or long-term valuation metrics. But if you mean general factors on what drives investing portfolios, we did an old paper where we looked at the old food pyramid from our youth that basically said when we were kids, you wanted to eat as much carbs as possible. So we're talking bread, pasta, like that was the base of the pyramid, which is probably inverted from the knowledge we may have today. And as we talk about that with investing too, and we kind of go start from the bottom and move up, so much time on the podcast or elsewhere, we're talking about like the final two or three pieces of the pyramid because we assume that people probably have the basics right, when in often reality is they actually probably don't. Base of the pyramid. It's like cooking. My mom is not too far away from you in the South, North Carolina. She was an old school Southern cook. Recipe's not exact. It's like by feel, by taste. So if you make chocolate chip cookies, as long as you have the main ingredients, they're probably going to end up okay. If you leave out chocolate chips or you leave out butter, or you leave out flour, something's going to mess up. So we say the starting point, the default for portfolios, and I promise I'll get to your question in a second, is you start with a globally diversified asset allocation. And what does that mean? That means global stocks, global bonds, and global real assets. The vast majority of Americans we talk to and investors all over the world, it's true everywhere, do not have that portfolio. They have a highly concentrated portfolio, almost always in their own country. So my Brazilian friends do this.
I would say almost everyone I know is very weighted toward S&P 500. And what you're saying is that's a bad thing, essentially.
So the US is a percentage of what we call global market cap in stocks, is about 60%. So the default is you should, on an index basis, put 60% in the US and the rest should be the rest of the countries in the world. But no one does this. The people in the US put all their money in the US. But the crazy thing is this is true everywhere. My Japanese friends, Chinese friends, Brazilian friends, Greek friends. And if you ask anyone in the US over the past 15 years, they're like, amazing idea. It's crushed. I put all my money in US stocks, particularly S&P. You ask anyone in any other country in the world, say, was it a great idea to put all your money in Russian stocks or even British stocks? And they say, no, it was a terrible idea.
China is like one of the worst performing markets in the last 5 years, right?
Yeah. You go back to the long arc of history. My favorite investing book, Triumph of the Optimist by Dimson Marsh Staunton, is a fantastic book because it shows the full history of investing in various markets. And it'll surprise a lot of people. US is one of the best performing markets. It went from not the largest market cap country in the world in 1900. UK was, but went all the way up to 60%. So huge move. But tiny South Africa and Australia were actually better performers.
US is roughly like 20% of global GDP, but 60% essentially of market cap. Is it just the winners accrue, and especially the Magnificent Seven, et cetera, they just tend to be more global companies? Or why is the US three times its weight in market cap?
There's a handful of topics that you've just touched on there. The first is looking at any point in time. One of my favorite tables, and we can send it over to you, is a snapshot of the top 10 stocks in the world by market cap by decade. So right now, that sucker is almost all US, particularly heavy in tech. But if you go back at various points in history, 2010 probably had a lot more diversified. China was probably pretty well represented. If you go back to the 1980s, it's like all Japanese. And Japan in the 80s was the largest stock market in the world at the time, bigger than the US.
Which is crazy when you think about that today. Nobody would have thought that.
Japan is such a great case study for so much. I'm actually headed to Japan this week. The yen is struggling, so a great time to travel. But Japan's a great case study because it's not some tiny country on the periphery. It's a top three world economy, top market cap country. And it had the biggest bubble we've ever seen in stocks. So my favorite bubble was 99. I was in college right down the road from you at Virginia. My professors trading stocks are in class. People just going nuts. But that was cute in comparison to the 80s bubble in Japan, was almost double what we saw in the US. But the Japanese stock market has now had decades and decades of no performance since then. This isn't the 30th biggest country in the world. This is one of the big three.
In some ways, it's very different. Like Japan is still doing zero interest rates. They're still much more weighted toward like trying to grow versus inflation.
Now, here's the interesting part is you're starting to see some changes. We manage a number of international portfolios and the culture around governance, how Japanese companies compete and really think about creative destructive has been changing in the past 10 years. So we actually are pretty, I mean, we're quantitative. It's not like I can say like we're waking up being bullish, but the models have been pointing towards Japan looking a lot better, certainly than it was 10, 20, 30 years ago. So we're getting pretty excited. And old Warren Buffett, Uncle Warren, has been buying up some Japanese companies too. And that's usually a good sign.
100% probably people listening to this podcast are very familiar with S&P 500, and that probably most of them own S&P 500 or some sort of derivation of something very close to that. Is there just like a simple index that you would suggest of, okay, here's the simple index outside that isn't talking your own book, but just basically a global index everyone uses?
Let me do a quick 1 minute deviation. First of all, 2024, best time ever in history to be an investor. There's limitless choice, particularly in the United States. You can invest in tax-efficient ETFs, for almost no cost. You are about a 0.03% cost. Unbelievable. And if you actually include short lending, that portfolio is probably expense ratio negative, meaning you're getting paid to own this portfolio. And that has its origins 50 years ago in what Jack Bogle, the late great founder of Vanguard, did with indexing. And indexing, what it used to mean 50 years ago, and this is lost on a lot of investors, so stick with me for a second, is if you're to talk to your spouse, your neighbor, your child, and say, hey, we invest in the S&P or something like it, what does that mean? And I think a lot of investors, they kind of understand. They say, well, it's the biggest companies. It's like Apple and Microsoft and Google. They say, yeah, but how do you weight those? And I think most investors miss that because it's actually just the price of the stock times the number of shares. There's no tether to the actual fundamentals. Does this company have earnings? Is it growing? Does it have sales? What's the valuation? None of that.
Is it rebalancing every month, every quarter? Like, how are they rebalancing?
The true definition of market cap weight is you simply own everything. So as a company gets bigger, you own more. As it gets smaller, you own less. And market cap is a great way of being average. But what it really enabled, the huge muscle movement, and this is going back to your question 10 minutes ago, is that it allowed companies to offer investing products for very low cost because you don't do anything. You don't have to rebalance a market cap index ever, other than if it, like M&A or spinoffs, those sort of thing. You don't do anything. So if you don't do anything, you don't have to charge much. And that was a huge innovation. But fast forward 50 years, where trading is frictionless, mostly at this point, you can offer other investing strategies that are not market cap weight, because the Achilles heel of market cap weighting, first of all, it's totally fine. Don't take the wrong message here. It's totally fine. The Achilles heel is when you have these boom, euphoric bubble periods. So 99, China in 2007, Japan in the 80s, on and on. You can find these periods. The market cap weighting, because it has no tether to fundamentals, goes completely bananas. So you end up putting most of your money in the most expensive companies, countries, sectors at the worst possible time. And so in Japan was the largest stock market in the world. If you were a global investor, you put most of your money in Japan when it was 100 PE in the 80s. That's crazy. Moving away from this market cap weight to something that has some sort of valuation focus, like a Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett style investing, is a slightly better way to do it. And you can do it in today's day and age with ETFs that are tax efficient. So international investor, there's plenty of international ETFs and indexes that'll get you to the starting point. And Vanguard, we certainly believe, is one of our favorites.
What's the point when someone should even really care? I mean, if you have a, let's say, under $1 million investable assets, and you spend all this time, you could probably spend that time saving money, getting better deal on your rent or something like that. You could spend more time just gathering knowledge instead of getting a 6% raise. If you got an 8% raise, in some ways, that would be a much higher return compounding. But then at a certain point, maybe it does make sense. Like, is there a tipping point where it actually makes sense to like actually really think about your portfolio?
Here's the challenge and here's the problem. The diagnosis is correct. If you spend time getting set up and have a good allocation, doesn't have to be perfect, just a good allocation from the get-go, you could do that and not look at it again for 10, 20 years and probably beat 90% of your friends. Low cost, tax efficient, global allocation. You can do that in all-in-one funds today, target date funds, all these sort of things. We have a couple, but the key is getting it set up okay. And then second, and this is the hardest part for everybody, is not mucking around with it.
Just not touching it.
The problem is we're all human. The euphoria, the late great Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's partner, used to always say, you know, if I've heard Warren say this 100 times, it's not fear and greed that drives markets, it's envy. So if your neighbor was invested in the Mag 7 last year and is bragging about their vacation to the Maldives and how much money they're making and their new house they're buying in Napa, or they're invested in some startups that hit, you feel that very real FOMO. My favorite real example of this is if you look, they have a sentiment study. They ask investors, are you bullish? Are you neutral? Are you bearish on stocks? And it goes back many decades. And the single highest bullish reading ever recorded in this study was December 1999, the single worst time to buy stocks in my entire lifetime. The single most bearish people were March 2009, the single best time to buy stocks during my lifetime. So the struggle is getting it set up and then not doing a bunch of dumb stuff. Now, if you're interested in markets, it's a hobbyist, that's one thing. The best way to add yield to your portfolio is to not spend any time on it, because the amount of your calculate your per hour fee, how many hours you spend a week scrolling Reddit, Twitter, not listening to podcasts, because that's hugely value add.
Of course.
Doing these things and you actually think it's going to be value added, I think is a stretch. So getting the basic setup, I think, is the most important part.
Now, for Americans, most of the people are listening here are Americans. U.S. has a global tax nexus. You can't outrun the tax man. So thinking about things that are tax efficient are quite valuable for founders. And a lot of people here are founders. What would you kind of advise founders to start thinking about outside of just maybe, let's say, the QSBS, which would be like the more common thing like a lot of founders think about?
I mean, QSBS, we did a poll. What percentage of people, and I have a pretty concentrated audience of professionals, who even knows what QSBS is and the extent you use it? Almost no one knew. Now, the founder startup community probably knows more. But let's start with the basics on the investing portfolio. Then we can get to the periphery. And we did a piece on this years ago called Sidewalk Money, which was kind of fun, which talks about things individuals can do. But one was, look, simply moving from a structure of example of a mutual fund, your standard average mutual fund, to an ETF in a taxable account, if you're a stock investor, on average, the benefit is usually bigger than the expense ratio benefit. So the average mutual fund today is still 1.25%. Now you can get them, they're down around 0.1%. But on average, the average one is 1.25%. And the average ETF is much cheaper. It's roughly half of that. But on top of that, the tax benefit, and no one usually cares about taxes till April rolls around or whatever the deadline is now. But if you think about it, that simple structural, because the ETF tends to be more tax efficient, is about a 0.7.
In the ETF, you only pay tax when you sell the ETF. So let's say you've got a gain after 5 years, you sell it, you pay tax on that gain. Whereas if you're owning the S&P 500, you're paying tax on the underlying assets, which could have dividends, could have other things that happen during that time.
Here's the differentiation. You're going to pay taxes likely on dividends no matter what, because they get distributed. But let's say you bought SPY, Spiders, S&P 500 back in the 90s and held it to today. You would have had zero capital gains distributions ever, because the structure of the ETF does it all in the background. Doesn't matter how much turnover on the fund is, you should have no capital gains distributions on average for that entire period. A mutual fund, just the way it's structured, if money comes in, money comes out, they have to buy and sell every day. So last year or year prior, there were mutual funds that were down 20, 30%. And on top of that, we're paying out 10 or 20% of the fund as capital gains income. And so you had this like double whammy. You're like, wait, I lost money on this fund and I have to pay taxes on it. It's a pretty nerdy, wonky topic. The simple takeaway is, on average, default to ETFs for two main reasons. On average, they're much cheaper than mutual funds and expenses matter. And second, on average, they're much more tax efficient than mutual funds are.
And not only are they more tax efficient, but then you also get to choose essentially when you pay the tax.
Correct.
You can say, okay, this year I'm going to take the gain for whatever reason, whereas this other year, that gain might be useful for me. Or if it goes down, I could sell and take the loss that year, whatever it is. For people who have Roths, some people over time can get a pretty sizable Roth, even if they have a 401k and they're putting the maximum in and stuff like that. How do you decide, okay, you've got a taxable account and you got your Roth, you can invest out of both. Do you put like more tax inefficient things like bonds or something like that in your Roth, and then you put more efficient things in your taxable? Assuming you're just thinking about it as one portfolio.
We often tell people they get sort of analysis paralysis when it comes to all these different accounts and saving vehicles. And if you look at the own goals, like in soccer, you score a goal on yourself, just the dumb decisions people make that are far more important than the exact specifics. We say get the main things right. So how much you save and invest in the first place, we believe outweighs almost all the other topics. And most investors, if you look, are you maxing out your 401k? Are you saving whatever the number is, 10, 20, 30% of your income? That usually swamps all the other decisions down the line. Once you have everything in place and not investing in a bunch of harebrained things, then you can start to optimize the tax efficiency. But even then, the challenge is with various people, is you can kind of make the cliche either way. Some people are going to be higher income and lower in retirement, and some are vice versa. Some are like, you know what, I'm going to move to Puerto Rico. So on average, you want to be paying less taxes than more. So having things like the higher income type of investments, we have yield again for the first time in forever in bonds, by the way, that was such a weird period, negative yielding interest rates. But we have yield again, and those type of yielding investments, if you want to put it in a tax sheltered account, you're not going to be paying taxes on it. But there's a lot of variability in this. The hard and fast rules a lot of people talk about, I think, can get a little squishy too. Main keys, just save and invest that sucker in the first place.
Now, for people in the tech sector, they've got obviously like a job in the tech sector. They're either owning the S&P 500, they're probably owning a lot of tech stocks. Either way, it's super weighted toward tech. They may even own real estate in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is very weighted toward tech. Should where you work be a factor of how you invest?
You know, if you think about times past, there were certainly a lot of people who used to invest. They would work at a company and invest their retirement all in the company's stock.
Like the Enron scenario.
You can always show the Amazons or Microsofts or Googles of the world where that was a great idea, but the thousands of other companies that did poorly. One of the biggest takeaways about investing in stocks, and one of the reasons that market cap indexing work that we talked about earlier, is you own everything, and everything in our world is driven by power laws. So the big, huge winners, my venture capital friends understand this, the startup world understands this far better than my public market friends for some reason, even though they do it every day, is the McDonald's, the Apples, these huge multi-bagger, what we call them, winners that do 20% a year for a decade or more, drive all the return. So it's like two-thirds of stocks underperform the broad index. It's about half don't make any money over their lifetime. And like a third straight up go to zero. And so as you think about that, from a retirement standpoint and how you invest your money, the chances are probably slim that you're going to end up with the next Google. And so diversifying makes a lot of sense. The example we gave earlier, and it's called home country bias, where everyone invests most of their money in their own country. And this is true with bonds too. It's actually true geographically in the US. So not surprisingly, people in California have a much higher tech weighting. People in Texas have a much higher energy weighting. People in the Northeast have a much higher financials weighting.
God, so it's even worse.
Yeah. This is a topic that I wrote a paper on a few years ago. This is one of my least read papers. It was called, What is the World's Safest Asset? Or during COVID, we did a multi-part series. It was like a four-part series. The first one is how I invest my own money. And it's a sad state of affairs, listeners, but the average mutual fund manager out there does not invest any money in his own fund, his or her fund, which is really sad.
Any? It's zero?
Any. Zero. The average, on average, is zero.
Even though they probably have a no-fee relationship with their own fund, they still don't invest in it?
They go on TV and tell everyone to buy their fund. And you say, well, do you own any? I always joke. I said, if you're an investor, ask, say, how much do you own? And I put all my public assets into our funds. But then we did an article called The Get Rich and Stay Rich. And we were talking about how it's a different mindset. And I said, the struggle with the stay rich portfolio is you think in terms of what is the safest asset out there and how do you invest, and starting to think about your human capital. And I said, this is somewhat of a chairlift conversation, meaning, you know, I love to ski, like you're sitting with some friends on a chairlift, nothing to talk about. So you start talking about these weird topics and thinking about your risks. I tend to be pretty non-consensus on this discussion. So going back to our beginning, where if you look at any asset and you ask people, say, what's the safest asset? Most people are going to say T-bills, short-term treasuries, money at the bank. And then you got the handful that are listening to this that are the coiners, Bitcoin or nothing, or crypto, whatever. Some people might say real estate. But the challenge is that everyone thinks in terms of a nominal world, day-to-day prices, and they ignore inflation. And so if you look at any one asset, it doesn't matter if it's US stocks, who've declined over 80%, real estate, so REITs, publicly traded REITs, have declined that much, commodities, certainly. Bonds, most people say T-bills, well, they've never declined. We say, well, hold on a second. After inflation, they've declined by over half. And so you end up saying, okay, well, how do I think about building this safe portfolio? Well, the first thing you want to do is not put all your money in one risk. And the vast majority of people put that all that money in one risk, which is the S&P, essentially, or even worse, targeting their own exposure through equity investments. And a lot of startup founders are certainly exposed to this. And it turns out, I can't say prove because that's not something you can say in my world. You can demonstrate that a globally diversified portfolio is actually safer than sitting in T-bills. And so by volatility, by maximum drawdown, and we were talking about this before the last couple of years. Listeners, if you own a bond fund, there's a good chance that sucker is down 10, 20, 50% in the last couple of years. And a lot of people don't know this. They think bonds differently. And that's a lot. And if you think about, that's because interest rates have gone from 0 to 5. But a globally diversified portfolio has done great. And so we said a lot of people are going to start to think about this with their safe money personally. What do I do with my cash if I have to save for an expense in 10, 20, 30 years, kids' education, et cetera, but also corporate treasury? And then what do they do with their money? And then all of a sudden you saw the Silicon Valley Bank, all that stuff go down last year, and people really started to rethink, what do they do with their safe money? But it's a good, I think, healthy exercise to have, to think about this concept of mentally bucketing, all right, this is sort of my get rich portfolio, and this is sort of my stay rich, because it's a conclusion that, and this is actually what we do at Cambria, we actually invest our, quote, safe money and don't just put it in T-bills, which I don't know really anyone else. I think Michael Saylor had the same exact thinking and diagnosis, but then he took a hard left and said, all right, you got to put it all in Bitcoin. And we took a hard right and said globally diversified, which, by the way, Bitcoin is a percentage of that global market portfolio too.
Speaking of Bitcoin, I mean, what's probably the biggest news in the ETF world has been these Bitcoin ETFs. Is that a big deal? Is it a small deal? Where do you come out on that?
I've been a sideline cheerleader. I haven't had a whole lot of involvement other than, I love to joke, I had a tweet on Twitter X back in 2013. And back then, I was like, there's no way an ETF is coming to market anytime soon. All my friends are spending millions on legal fees, but I'm willing to make a bet with anyone that ETF spot Bitcoin ETF comes to market. Let's do dinner. I prefer sushi.
Sorry, in 2013? In the beginning of 2013, the price of Bitcoin was like $50 or something like that.
I used to re-up that bet every year. I was like, there's no way it's coming to market. Like, the regulators are just not going to allow it. But then over the last year or two with my friends in that world, they're like, it's getting pretty close. I have a really unsatisfying take on this for everyone, because there's the Bitcoin lovers and the Bitcoin haters, and it's going to be equally unsatisfying to both. People will come up to me over the last decade and say, Meb, I'm thinking about putting some money in Bitcoin or whatever, Ethereum. What do you think? And I say, hey, look, the starting point is the global market portfolio, which we mentioned earlier. If you just buy every public asset in the world, every public stock, every public bond, every public trading, real estate, and then commodities too, what do you end up? You end up with a portfolio that's roughly half stocks and roughly half bonds, and it's globally diversified. Foreign bonds are actually a bigger asset class than US bonds are. And that's around, let's call it rounding, $200 trillion. The two things that are missing from that are single family real estate in the rest of the world, as well as a lot of farmland, which we talk a lot about on the podcast. But of that, Bitcoin, let's call it maybe 0.5% of the world market cap. I say, all right, you want to put Bitcoin in your portfolio. If your portfolio is 100 grand, you can put in, what is that, 500 bucks? No one wants to hear that. They either want to hear, I got to put in half my money, or I got to put in none or short it. The binary way of which people think about any investments is really dangerous. We always say going halvesies, very technical term, is a thoughtful way to think about it. So for us, you put in 0.5%, it goes up, great. Now you have a 5%, a 10%, a 20%, and it goes to zero, it's not that big of a deal. So thinking in terms of that, I think market cap default is useful, although most won't go that route.
There are scenarios where all of a sudden something becomes like an overweight. Let's say you're an early Bitcoin person and high conviction, you put 1% in it, and now it's 15% of your portfolio or something. And you're like, I don't know what to do. I don't know if I can sell and take the tax loss. I don't know how I can deal with that. What do you suggest somebody once they're overweighted somewhere?
There's a lot of behavioral biases we have as investors. There's a lot of wonderful writers and books on this topic. And I have all the biases, which is why I'm a quant. I'll take too much risk if you give it to me. I'm overconfident. My favorite analogy here when talking about positions to investors is, say, if you ask investors, and we love to do polls on my Twitter, and I say, do you have a written investing plan? 90% do not. And if not, more. And I say, it doesn't have to be complicated. It could be on one sheet of paper. It could be on one index card. It could be, I invest in the global portfolio. I rebalance once a year. Boom. I try to contribute 10% of my earnings to savings. It could be a 20-page document. I think CalPERS is like 300 pages, but it doesn't have to become. But why is that useful? It's useful because if Bitcoin goes to 500,000, you pull that thing out and you say, okay, this was my default. Here's how I can maybe deviate from this or think about it. But most people are just winging it. And it's important, not just from the standpoint of when you're losing money. So you buy a stock at 100, it goes down to 80. Well, that was dumb. I shouldn't have listened to my neighbor. I'll just sell it when it gets back to 100. Well, then it goes down to 50 and you're like, oh, I'm never talking to that person again. It goes down to 20. There's no point in selling it. Now it goes to zero. It's also useful on the flip side. You buy a stock at 100, it goes to 200. You're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm making so much money. I'm thinking about this vacation to the Amalfi Coast, or I'm thinking about this new Tesla I'm going to buy, on and on. But every 10, 100 bagger was at once a double. And so thinking in terms of how you're going to deal with not just the losers, but the winners is hugely important. And so this is why we often say learning history is table stakes for investors, because it gives them expectations on all the weird stuff that's happened in the last 150 years. With the knowledge, it could get weirder. And so thinking, hey, the Russian stock market's paused. Well, that's happened before. Certain market, China is down, like you mentioned, what, 60, 70% now? Well, that's happened before. You have this base case to work from, and thinking in terms of the things that do great, we become emotionally attached to our investments. You don't believe me, listeners? Pause this, walk out to your garage, look at all the junk you got in there, and think, hey, if I cleaned out my garage, there was a flood, and the garage was empty, would I go buy all that stuff again? Of course not. No chance in the world. But investors become attached. We all become attached to what we own. And that creates a problem, which is the emotions get in. And then that fractures all of our logic and reasonable reasoning.
Now, on angel investing, you've made a lot of personal angel investments. I think you've made over 250 in the last decade. What are some of the, like, the big learnings there?
So there's a lot. When this started, I've kind of publicly documented this on the podcast and on the blog. My day job is managing ETFs. We got over 100,000 investors, but I like to learn about other topics on our podcast. We talk about investing in Kazakhstan or farmland investing, investing in Africa, all these topics. But from the standpoint of an area that I don't know about, I like to start small, but also have some skin in the game. It reminds me of Warren Buffett used to talk about, hey, I want to track this company. I'm going to buy one share in their stock. That way I get an annual report every year and I'm forced to read it. It keeps you engaged. So when we started this a long time ago, I said, look, this is an area I don't know much about and I would like to learn a lot. And I know my style, it's like teaching. You are forced to learn and pay attention. And if I'm using real money, which is painful for me to lose, I'll pay more attention. So I said, all right, well, if I lose all my money, I'm going to do this for, say, 3-5 years. If I lose all my money, I'm okay with that. If I break even, great. If I match the S&P, gravy. If I make money, wonderful. But I'm going to consider this an education and tuition. And I'm going to start to learn. And everyone I know in this world that gets started has this massive temptation because it's fun and exciting where they just want to cannonball in. You see a couple deals, you want to put all your money in, and I said, look, I'm going to space this out over 5 years. I'm going to place a lot of small bets and learn and realize I'm going to make a lot of mistakes. But this concept of these power laws, and we have a piece on our blog called Journey to 100X that has a lot of links and resources, again, because public markets, this is true as well, and start to understand the goods and the bads. And we've seen a lot of it. I tend to tweet about a lot of the the bad behavior too. But yeah, I think it's up close to 350 companies now. It might even be knocking on 400.
And some of them are just like, okay, you're in some angelist syndicate and you put a really tiny amount in and stuff, or?
Yeah. We tell listeners, there's a handful of the platforms. AngelList is probably the biggest. WeFunder. And then there's some esoteric ones that focus on specific areas like agriculture. And then there's also a lot of direct ones. Jason Calcanis has one. And traditionally, the model is these syndicate leads will bring a deal that is a VC deal. So it's an actual round that maybe Sequoia or other groups are doing. And you end up paying a carry for that opportunity. To me, I tell people, I say, sign up for every possible syndicate you can, and you don't have to start investing. Like, you can just kind of paper invest for a year, understand the lingo, understand some of the links that these investors may have incentives that may not line up with the end investor, on and on and on, and just start to wade in. You don't have to dive in head first.
A lot of the syndicates, the minimum check size may only be $1,000 or something. So it's a lot more accessible for most people.
And this is true with public markets too. Resist the temptation that feel like you have to be all in or all out, and come up with a plan. Say, look, I'm going to do this for 5 years. I'm going to write 10 checks a year, roughly $1,000 a year, and try it out. And maybe after 2 years, you're like, this is too much work. For me, it's been hugely beneficial because it does two things. One, it helps you kind of look around the corner to public markets. Two, it's helped my business a lot because we see companies and ideas that we can incorporate and use. And there's been a ton of those over the years. And it's infinitely optimistic. So going back to my world of public markets all day long, it's just pessimism and negativity. And this one, every company is, well, not every company. Some are just not that exciting, but others like changing the world. We're doing cool stuff. You have to be the naive optimism of a founder, because the reality is most of us fail. You have to think you're going to be one of the special ones, which it's hard, as you know.
I love asking founders how investing made them a better CEO. But for you, I want to really ask you how podcasting has made you a better investor, or has it?
The first academic paper I ever wrote came out in 2007 in the journal Wealth Management. This is also the only academic paper I've ever written. Part of which is because the academic process, which seems to be in the news a lot recently, is a very long and antiquated process. My paper went behind a paywall, all this just nonsense. And I said, you know what? I can post a paper online and I'm going to get feedback instantaneously. How stupid this is, or how great of people replicate it. Like, it's instant. Other than having to wait for a year to have four people read it. And it just is a process that seems out of date. And so content for me, and being able to come up with ideas and publish them over the past 15 years, has been essential. Now, part of that is because we were a bootstrap business and couldn't afford to pay out to hire a lot of people or to advertise or to market. Like, we had to bootstrap it. And so in the early days, it was blogs and white papers and books. More modern has been podcasting and Twitter and who knows what else next. But it helps you, as you know, refine your process and think about what do you really believe and not. And that as you test things, sometimes it causes you to change your views. And I've changed my views on a lot of things over the years as the markets have developed. And podcasting, for me, more than anything, it's just been fun, because you can just ring someone up and say, hey, you know, I'm interested in, we did a whole series on investing in space companies before it was, I think, hot. And then we did a whole series on investing in Africa. A lot of the emerging market startup system, I think, is incredibly interesting at an inflection point over the past 5 years. I think most of my top 10 best performers have been ex-US at this point, which is crazy. But more than anything, it lets you test your views. And as we know, with social, people let you know very quickly, one way or the other, how they feel about it, which has been useful too.
One of the things I love about the internet is you can quickly learn when you're wrong. They'll let you know. In fact, some of my best engagement things on the internet have been things that are completely off. Those are the ones that get the highest engagement, not the things that are really interesting or on that are out there.
And to the young people who are thinking about or nervous to start or start publishing things, we always say, just start publishing. You learn to develop a thicker skin. We have a lot of friends, particularly for my female friends, the world can be a pretty cruel place on social. And we say, look, in the moment, it often can be hurtful, but fast forward a year or two, and some of the comments are actually really funny. I say a very cathartic way to go about it is to get a Google sheet. Anytime somebody says anything really terrible or a troll, just throw it in the sheet, because it's kind of like a washing your hands feeling. Then you forget about it. You don't have to respond to it, and you can reflect on it over the years. And we did a tweet when we passed $2 billion in assets that over the years had just marked all the milestones, but with troll comments that people had made about me specifically, but our firm and ideas and everything, is keeping receipts. It's a much more cleansing feeling and way to go about it than just getting all angry at some cartoon avatar on Twitter.
But it is hard. either need to attack it the way you are, which is kind of like with humor or something. You need some sort of strategy to attack it because the comments can be very hurtful. If they even have some idea of who you are, they'll figure out how to hurt you in a way that can be hurtful.
Yeah, for sure.
I've heard you say that travel is really the only way Americans understand currency prices. With that in mind, what countries would you recommend our listeners travel to this year?
There's nothing better an investor can do besides studying history than to actually travel, because you start to learn a great deal outside of our own borders. So the cultural aspect aside, certainly, we love talking about Japan on the podcast, A, because I love to ski there. And that's a big secret. I feel like I should stop talking about it. But I say it's a fun fact that most people around the world don't know that Japan is even a place really to ski. But Japan, again, going back to their 80s boom, has more ski resorts than any country in the world, which I think surprises a lot of people.
It has more ski resorts than the U.S.?
More than the U.S. It's like 500. Now, a lot of these are little mom and pop ones, of course. And I think we've done about 20.
But those are fun to stay at.
Exactly. And the onsens, the sushi, the ramen, on and on. The nicest people in the world. But it goes back to the 80s when they had this huge economic boom. And I'll do happy hours with traders and investors in Tokyo. And the concept of like a buy and hold investing strategy is totally foreign. They're like, why would you buy and hold stocks? Because they don't go up. Because their stocks haven't gone up. Everyone tends to extrapolate their own experience with markets. So if you talk to someone in any other country about what investing has been like, you go over to my favorite example. I have said this many times on the podcast, but going down to Colombia and South America, I was there at a particular time, I think in 2014, where their market was really expensive. But everyone's bullish and the money's pouring in, and you can never foresee a time when stocks would go down. And here they have gone down a ton since then, and now they're really cheap. But if you go to a place where stocks are super cheap, usually that's because they went down 60, 80% already. And you tell someone that and they say, well, that's obvious. No crap, Meb. I know that, but we have no money. All my money has gone down. Or you talk to people in other countries. So, all right, countries. If you're in Japan skiing, come say hi. Konnichiwa. And then I have a few on my to-do list that I haven't been to or spent time in, but the US dollar has certainly been very strong. And on a purchasing power parity basis, it's definitely overvalued. It's not totally crazy, but towards Japan is one of the bigger spreads. The old Big Mac index, good way to look at how to think about currencies. I've never been to Africa, so that is high on my list of places to go. I have a six-year-old. So we took him to New Zealand. My niece is in vet school there. So we ran around New Zealand, which is like a young kid's playground. It's like the best place in the world to take a six-year-old. High on my list. I've never been to Africa. I would really like to spend some time in some countries in South America. I've never been to Brazil or Uruguay, which may be Christmas time, but open to ideas.
Okay, cool. A couple more personal questions before we leave. What is a conspiracy theory that you believe?
My answer earlier on the Fed is a humor one, but is one that I think is not that far off from reality. We think about everyone in our world having divine ability to forecast the future. And so the amount of time that people gravitate like flies to these forecasts of what is the S&P going to do this year? Where are bonds going to go? With the full knowledge that it's going to make no difference. Like, that's the crazy part of like this whole forecasting and looking at the Fed or their dot plots and then looking at how wrong they are every single time. It shifts the investor's perspective. We have a quote that we say it's better to be Rip Van Winkle than Nostradamus in our world, where meaning you invest, you have this great portfolio, you forget about it for a while versus trying to divine the future. Now, that having been said, I run an active management business. Like, our goal is to try to outperform. It's weird coming from that starting point. I think if the Fed watched Seinfeld, drank some pale ales, and just pegged the two-year, I think that would not be a bad thing.
All right. Last question we ask all of our guests. What conventional wisdom or advice do you think is generally bad advice?
Oh, there's so much. Oh, boy. I mean, this is essentially my entire 20 list. I love to poke a lot of the big boys. And one of my current favorite targets, there's a lot of these giant institutions around the world. CalPERS is my local favorite, where they spend countless amounts of resources millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars on this effort to manage their portfolios, not just with people, but particularly with fees. And on average, and we've written articles about this, we said one many years ago called "Should CalPERS Be Managed by a Robot? Should Harvard Be Managed by a Robot?" On and on and on. And the evidence shows that they would probably be better off firing everyone and buying a bunch of ETFs. And that's not popular. And I jokingly on Twitter apply for their chief investing officer role because they get a new CIO about every other year for the past 10 years. I think it's actually more than that. It's like the Carolina Panthers head coaching job. And there's so much drama situated with this. And how much better would it be to just move on and make this systematic? And so I just found out Friday that they declined again to interview me for their CIO job. We're going to launch a publicly traded fund, ETF, that is going to target, say, CalPERS and all these big institutions and say, all right, here's your investable benchmark now. Can you beat me? Because if you can't, you got a lot of constituents to answer to. And I think this particular cycle, this late stage private equity world of what they used to call leverage buyouts, everyone is hoping this is going to be the savior for a lot of these investment institutions. And I think there's some setting up for quite a bit of disappointment there. But here we are in 2024, the US stock market's a little bit expensive. So we'll see. But I think the CIO job is not going to be mine again.
But for these big pension funds or endowments and stuff like that, they're getting wined and dined, like to get Super Bowl tickets. It'd be very hard for them to just say, hey, we're giving up our job. We're going to go do something else. Even though they may get paid less than they would at another asset management or for-profit institution, it doesn't seem like your idea is ever going to stick. It doesn't seem like it'll have the political, even though the public would be better off, the pensioners would be better off, the endowment would be better off, et cetera.
The challenge is their CIO role is not an investment role. And that sounds funny because the I in CIO is investment, but it's really more about being a politician and being able to craft a narrative to all the various constituents about why you're doing what you're doing, because there's so many invested parties. The problem with that is you end up with so much, what are those, like Rube Goldberg machines to just come out with something on the end, which is just a basic portfolio. It's kind of a mess. So it actually would be my worst nightmare to be CIO there, of course.
If it's an endowment for a big university or something, then like whatever, like I'm okay with that because it's just that is going to be suffer. If you're actually managing money on behalf of pensioners, they're relying on this money to retire on. And then you really do have a responsibility to those people. These are not usually wealthy people, these pensioners. They're clear middle class folks who really are relying on this to retire. If you significantly underperform, these people are really going to suffer.
And it's funny because you mentioned the endowments. My very first book was on the endowments. And you've seen Harvard and Yale, who have been incredibly successful for many decades. So going back 50 plus years, and Yale really being the gold star for this. But Harvard really seeing the challenges of this model for the past decade plus, where the students, when times are good, all these different people complain about how much everyone's making and the Harvard all these different places investing, it shouldn't be investing. And then when it's not making good returns, everyone's like, we need to be making higher returns. And so you've seen on Harvard all the downside of this struggle of a lot of people being involved in the model versus Yale, which has had a pass because they've just done so exceptionally well. And it'll be interesting to see in the post David Swensen, who's really the GOAT of the endowment management world, whether they'll be able to sustain this sort of model in the future, because it's not easy.
This has been awesome. Thank you, Meb Faber, for joining us on World of DAS. I follow you at Meb Faber on Twitter. I definitely encourage our listeners to engage with you there. This has been a ton of fun.
Hey, man, it was great. Look forward to seeing you in the real world, particularly at one of these dinners.
Yeah, or on the ski slopes in Japan.
If you're a super data nerd, go to worldofdas.com. That's DAAS, worldofdas.com, and sign up for our weekly data as a service Roundup newsletter.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, consider rating this podcast and leaving a review. For more World of DAS, and DAS is DAAS, you can subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcasts. And also check out YouTube for videos. You can find me at Twitter at Auren, that's AUREN, Auren, and we'd love to hear from you. World of DAS is brought to you by Safegraph. Safegraph is geospatial data for physical places. Check it out at safegraph.com. And by Flex Capital. Flex Capital invests in data companies like those we talk about at World of DAS. Check it out at flexcapital.com.